Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Monday, September 26, 2022. The Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell praising Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema as the most effective first-term senator I've seen in my time in the Senate. Senator Sinema spoke today at the McConnell Center at the University of Louisville about the importance, she says, she places on bipartisanship and also in support of the 60-vote filibuster threshold. In fact, she says it should be restored for Supreme Court justices and executive branch nominees. U.S. Senate and U.S. House not in session today for the Jewish holiday of Rosh Hashanah. We'll talk with a reporter about a major bill up this week keeping the federal government from shutting down with a temporary funding measure called the CR or Continuing Resolution and the controversy over attaching an energy project permitting reform bill. President Joe Biden holding a White House Competition Council meeting announcing steps to make airline ticket fees more transparent to consumers. Residents in parts of Tampa, Florida getting mandatory evacuation orders as Hurricane Ian gets closer and gets stronger. We'll hear from Governor Ron DeSantis and also White House preparations. Russian President Vladimir Putin gives Russian citizenship to Edward Snowden, the former U.S. intelligence contractor who fled to Russia in 2013 after he leaked secret files that revealed domestic and international surveillance operations by the NSA. Edward Snowden still wanted in the U.S. on espionage charges. And the White House announcing President Biden will host his first state dinner on December 1st. The invitees, the French President Emmanuel Macron and his wife Brigitte. We start with Senator Kyrsten Sinema, Democrat from Arizona, visiting the McConnell Center at the University of Louisville in Kentucky. Ahead of the visit, the Arizona Republic writing that Senator Sinema has faced criticism within her party for sometimes helping Republicans stymie progressive legislation, and that Senator Sinema and West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin often have been thorns in the sides of many of their fellow Democrats since their party won a razor-thin majority in the Senate in early 2021. The article goes on, that's largely because their votes have been crucial to determining the fate of some of Democrats' highest priority legislation, and sometimes they've withheld that needed support. Introducing Senator Sinema, the person who the McConnell Center is named for, Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, the minority leader.
Today, I have the privilege of introducing the senior senator from Arizona. I've only known Kyrsten for 4 years. But she is, in my view, and I've told her this before, the most effective first-term senator I've seen in my time in the Senate. She is today what we have too few of in the Democratic Party, a genuine moderate and a deal maker. She's always looking, you know, some of you have heard me say, I always feel like if you're looking at a football field and you've got divided government or a lot of big differences on big issues, look for the things within the 40-yard lines that you can agree on and try to do those. Well, we've done some of that, even though this is an all-Democratic government right now. We've done some of that, and Kyrsten has been right in the middle of, if not the principal leader of, getting us to an outcome in a highly partisan time on infrastructure, on school safety, mental health, postal reform, the CHIPS bill, you name it, every single thing that we've been able to work together on. Now, we've got some very big differences, as you know, but every single thing that we've had an opportunity to work together on, she's been a leader of and involved in and is extraordinarily effective. As you can tell, I have a very high opinion of the Senator from Arizona, but my biggest compliment to her is she protects the institution of the Senate. Some of you may recall the former president would harangue me on virtually a weekly basis about trying to lower the threshold in the Senate from 60 to 51. In other words, to turn the Senate into the House. If we did that, we'd have fancier desks, but we'd be a lot like the House. And how that would damage the country is things would go back and forth and back and forth and lack of stability. That's not what the Founding Fathers had in mind when they created the United States Senate. They created it to stop bad stuff and to allow things that we could agree on to go forward. That was not fashionable in the Democratic Party in the last year and a half. It took one hell of a lot of guts for Kyrsten Sinema to stand up and say, I'm not going to break the institution in order to achieve a short-term goal.
The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell at the McConnell Center at the University of Louisville introducing Senator Sinema. We have the entire program at our video library at cspan.org. Senator Sinema went on to give a speech about the importance of bipartisanship in her view and to highlight some of the bipartisan bills that she said she's worked on over the past couple of years that have been signed into law, including the infrastructure spending bill and the one addressing gun violence. And she reiterated her support for the 60-vote threshold for a filibuster. During the question-and-answer period, she elaborated on that support.
So, hi, Senator Sinema. Thank you for being here with us today. My name is Madeline, and I'm a staff member with the McConnell Center, and I'll now take us into the Q&A portion. First, you touched on this in your talk, but can you expound on why you hold such support for the filibuster, especially when many others in your party have opposing views?
That's such a great question, Madeline. You know, Senator McConnell mentioned this in his opening remarks, and I mentioned it in my remarks as well. The danger of eliminating the 60-vote threshold is that the Senate becomes the House. And I remind everyone, I left the House and ran for the Senate for a reason. I remember my early years, I served for 6 years in the House of Representatives. I remember being so frustrated during those 6 years because it felt like every time there was a big bipartisan solution that needed to happen, the Senate just kind of came up with a solution and then gave it to the House and we just ate it. And that's why I ran for the Senate. Yeah. I thought, wait a second, they're doing the work. The reality is that if you were to eliminate the 60-vote threshold in the Senate would become like the House, smaller, older, but basically like the House. And the trouble with that is that, you know, the House, with elections every 2 years, representing a smaller group of voters by each House, they really represent the passions of the moment in the political spectrum. So as you all know, control changes between the House and the Senate every couple of years. It's likely to change again in just a few weeks, right? And so when the House passes legislation, it represents that kind of rapidly shifting. Was that, everything's fine, right? Great. Not everyone likes me, so just check in, you know? So the House passes legislation that represents the passions of the moment. And that's what it was designed to do when our forefathers created the House. They wanted a body that represented the passions of Americans at the moment. But they tend to be a little bit over eager. So when Republicans are in control, they pass a little bit of crazy legislation. And when the Democrats are in control, they pass a little bit of crazy legislation. And the job of the Senate is to cool that passion. You know, there's a saying that the House is the cup of hot tea, and the Senate is the saucer in which you cool that tea. The Senate was designed to be a place that moves slowly, to cool down those passions, to think more strategically and long-term about the legislation before us. And most importantly, it was designed to require comity, to require people to compromise and work together. So the legislation we pass represents the viewpoints of a broad spectrum of the country, not just the passion of the moment. And so while it is frustrating as a member of the minority in the United States Senate, and equally frustrating as a member of the majority, right? Because you must have 60 votes to move forward. That frustration represents solely the short-term angst of not getting what you want. And those of you who are parents in the room know that the best thing you can do for your child is to not give them everything they want, right? And that's important to the United States Senate as well. We shouldn't get everything we want in the moment, because later, upon cooler reflection, you recognize that it has probably gone too far. So the importance of the 60-vote threshold is to ensure that no one gets everything they want, that you compromise, that you find that middle ground. And by doing so, you're much more likely to pass legislation that stands the test of time, that will not be reversed when the next party gains power. That's the importance of the 60-vote threshold. It's become politicized intensely in recent years. Our last president wanted to eliminate it every couple of days. Our current president talks about it on Twitter all the time. They're both wrong. They're both wrong. Because if we were to give in to that moment of wanting just what you want, the reversal that would come in a year or 2 years would not only be bad for the American body, it'd be bad for businesses, be bad for state and local governments, and be bad for us as Americans to think that we should always feed our short-term desires rather than thinking about the long-term. So not only am I committed to the 60-vote threshold, I have an incredibly unpopular view. I actually think we should restore the 60-vote threshold for the areas in which it has been eliminated already. We should restore it. Yeah, not everyone likes that. Because it would make it harder. It would make it harder for us to confirm judges, and it would make it harder for us to confirm executive appointments in each administration. But I believe that if we did restore it, we would actually see more of that middle ground in all parts of our governance, which is what I believe our forefathers intended.
Senator Kyrsten Sinema, Democrat from Arizona, today at the McConnell Center at the University of Louisville in Kentucky, named after and introduced by Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican and the current minority leader. That 60-vote threshold for non-Supreme Court judicial nominees and executive branch nominees ended in 2013 when Democrats had the majority in the U.S. Senate. And then in 2017, Republicans had the majority and ended it for Supreme Court nominees. A new Gallup poll finding Americans approve of Congress, approval rating 23% in September, and that's the highest level of the year. The low point was in June, 16%. A story at Politico, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell urging Senate Republicans to vote no on advancing Senator Joe Manchin's permitting reform legislation as part of a government funding package, according to three people familiar with the effort. The article goes on, it's an ominous development that puts the West Virginia Democrats' legislation in peril as he works behind the scenes to drum up support. Government funding runs out Friday at midnight. More on this from Natalie Andrews, Wall Street Journal congressional reporter. She was interviewed on C-SPAN's Washington Journal program this morning.
We expect the Senate to move tomorrow to vote for a continuing resolution, a stopgap bill. The catch there is that the bill is going to have Joe Manchin's permitting reform bill on it. This is a deal that he made with Chuck Schumer back in August in order to pass the big reconciliation bill. He wanted this legislation attached to a must-pass bill, and Schumer is going to do that on the continuing resolution. However, we don't know if that bill will have 60 votes in the Senate, and especially enough votes in the House to get it over the finish line, because a lot of House Democrats have said they don't want to support it. So it's interesting. We're again going into the last week of September with a lot of unease, knowing that the vote tomorrow may not actually be a vote that can get the government funded and passed by Friday.
Your colleague at the Wall Street Journal, Katie Farrick, today laying out what's actually in that permitting reform bill. Here's what she writes. That bill would speed up the approval process for energy-related projects across the country, including natural gas pipelines, electricity transmission lines, wind farms, solar power installations. It would set a 2-year target for the duration of the most detailed category of review required by the federal government's National Environmental Policy Act. And it would also order the White House to designate 25 projects that cut energy costs and improve energy reliability and cut carbon emissions as priorities for the federal agency review, putting pressure on U.S. officials to keep reviews from languishing. That's in today's Wall Street Journal. Also in today's Wall Street Journal, Joe Manchin himself making his case for the passage of his bill. The question, I guess, for you is what happens if this doesn't have the support? Is Joe Manchin essentially daring his colleagues here to shut down the government because they don't like his permitting bill?
He is. He is saying that this is good policy. He's tried to make that case. And it's interesting in talking to senators the past 2 weeks, lawmakers largely do see a need for some sort of permitting reform, but there's a lot of disagreement on what that is, right? So now you have Joe Manchin who in some cases doesn't have a ton of goodwill with some of these members. In other cases, yes, he does. They're thrilled that he got a reconciliation bill over the line, and they will support it. So it's just kind of those margins of understanding, will people come along? Will they say, okay, this bill is great? They didn't have text until late last week to look at it. And so it's unclear if maybe seeing that text, having that percolate around for the weekend has eased some stress about the permitting reform bill. We're all going to see, and hopefully we see it before Friday so the government can avoid a shutdown.
Is there any other legislation at this point that could hitch a ride on that government funding bill? Anything else that you're watching?
Yeah, so two main things that we expect to see jump on that is more aid for Ukraine. The conflict there, as we know, Putin has committed to escalate, and more funding in the tune of about $12 billion does have support from Republicans and Democrats. It's unclear, I will note, how much longer Republicans want to continue funding this war and also funding the Ukraine government. But right now, there is money for aid on that. There is expected to be aid money on that bill. We also expect to see some money to help Jackson, Mississippi with their water crisis right now. That's one thing we're watching. And then also there was a deal struck to add an FDA user fee renewal on the continuing resolution. It was something that was also expiring at the end of September. And since the CR is the train leaving the station, it looks like it will catch a ride.
The continuing resolution, if it does get passed, the expectation is that it would just punt this debate to the lame duck. Is that correct?
Yes. Seems like most lawmakers would like to see the deadline out into December. We often see them push it to like mid-December, and sometimes right before Christmas Eve, they enjoy punting it right to a deadline that inspires some motivation among lawmakers to get something done so they can get out for the Christmas holiday. But yeah, I would expect it to go until Christmas. There are House Republicans and some others saying that it should go into January, where they expect Congress to change control and they'd like to weigh in a little bit more. But it does seem like December's where things are headed.
Natalie Andrews is a congressional reporter with the Wall Street Journal, joining C-SPAN on this morning's Washington Journal program. The Senate is back on Tuesday, 3 p.m. Eastern. The House returns to session on Wednesday at noon Eastern. As always, you can follow Congress on the C-SPAN networks live. Senator Joe Manchin was asked about his energy permitting reform bill and that government funding bill, the CR continuing resolution, and Republican opposition to his bill during an appearance on Sunday on Fox News Sunday.
Well, certainly you understand why Republicans don't think they should be the ones to come across the aisle to vote for a measure that primarily benefits you, which was done in exchange for your vote on a measure they didn't support. Like a single one of them vote for the Inflation Reduction Act. Politico says this. They're quoting Senator John Cornyn, a top Republican. Given what Senator Manchin did on the reconciliation bill, it's engendered a lot of bad blood. There's not a lot of sympathy on our side to provide Senator Manchin a reward. So how can you expect them to vote for this now?
Shan, this is not about me. My Republican friends, I've been working for 12 years with them, and I know their number one item that they've had and number one priority they've had is permitting reform. We can't build anything in America. It takes 5 to 10 years. The developed world takes 1 to 3 years. And why should we be so far behind the developed world to bringing products to market, to be able to have the infrastructure to move energy around? And we're asking people around the world to do things for us we won't do for ourselves. My Republican friends know exactly where we are. This is not about the previous legislation. This is something, a high priority that we have for our country. It's a time in history. If we don't, Shannon, take advantage of this and come together as Americans, we're going to look back 5, 10 years from now and wonder why we're not able to meet the demands, why we're allowing Putin to kind of control the dictate the energy policies. And what we're trying to respond to and not able to do it in a timely fashion, because we can't move the energy in America, whether it's going to be new transmission lines for renewables or basically for fossil and oil and gas that moves the products we need today. That's what this is about. And we need to come together as Americans.
Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, on Sunday on the Fox News Sunday program. Again, the test vote of the government funding measure with the energy reform bill. 60 votes will be needed to advance it, expected on Tuesday. President Joe Biden hosting his third meeting of his new White House Competition Council. The Twitter account White House says that the goal of the council is to lower prices for consumers, raise wages for workers, and promote innovation. One announcement today concerning giving consumers more information about airline ticket fees. The Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg says in a press release that airline passengers deserve to know the full true cost of their flights before they buy a ticket. More from the president at the start of the meeting at the White House.
My administration also cracking down on the airlines. Last month, if your flight was canceled or delayed, no top airline explicitly guaranteed to cover your meals if you were away from home, and only one guaranteed free rebooking, when the delay and cancellation was totally their fault. I joke now that, you know, for the first time in a long time, a plane doesn't leave when I get there, because it's Air Force One. But all kidding aside, you're taking your family somewhere in your situation where, you know, they cancel on you and you have to pay a fee to rebook. Come on, man. No, really, it's just simply not fair. It's not fair. Secretary Buttigieg just called them out, and guess what happened? Now 9 airlines cover hotels and meals when you're away from home, and 10 rebook for free. You know, it could have cost you up to $200 to have to rebook a flight. And that's $200 you can pay your monthly bills, your electric bill, or whatever. And that's progress. And today, the Department of Transportation released some new rules to require airlines and search websites to disclose these fees up front. So you have a choice. Go to the airline, doesn't charge the fee. Change, that doesn't have the fee. That's competition. Fees for things like sitting next to your child on an airplane, or checking the bags, or changing your ticket. By the way, most people would help pay your fee if you sick the child somewhere. But all kidding aside, think about it. Think about it. I mean, anyway, I don't want to get started. But that's competition. Fees for things like sitting next to your child, checking your bag, etc. You should know the full cost of your ticket right when you're comparison shopping to begin with, what airline you're going to fly with, so you can pick the ticket that actually is the best deal for you.
President Joe Biden at the White House at the start of a White House Competition Council meeting, the council created by the president by executive order last year. Another announcement today from the council concerning meat prices. Reuters reports the U.S. Department of Agriculture is proposing regulations to prevent meat companies from retaliating against livestock and poultry farmers who speak out on practices such as price fixing, the agency said on Monday. On Wall Street today, the Dow down 329, NASDAQ down 65, S&P down 38. Wall Street Journal reporting that the Dow Jones Industrial Average slid into a bear market Monday, a decline reflecting investor concerns about the pace of global growth and the price of central bank efforts to slow inflation. The blue chip index's decline of 1.1%, or the 330 points, was the fifth down trading day in a row. The Wall Street Journal article goes on, the move puts the Dow into its first bear market, defined in Wall Street parlance as a drop of 20% or more from a recent high since the early days of the pandemic. Also today, a new estimate about the cost of President Biden's federal student loan forgiveness plan. That plan, again, is $10,000 forgiven for those making under $125,000 and $20,000 forgiven for people who use Pell Grants. The Congressional Budget Office saying today the cost will be about $430 billion, or about 25% of all federal student loan debt. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts or on the free C-SPAN Now video app. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis declaring a statewide emergency as Hurricane Ian gets closer. He's telling residents to follow any local evacuation orders. And for those who will shelter in place, prepare for power outages lasting a couple of days. But don't panic buy gas, water, and other supplies. Governor DeSantis holding a news conference this morning with the leaders of other state agencies at the Emergency Operations Center in the capital city, Tallahassee.
As of 11 a.m., the storm is located roughly 375 miles south of Key West, and it's moving north-northwest at about 14 miles per hour. Maximum sustained winds are now up to 80 miles an hour, and it moves into the Gulf, where it's expected to strengthen into a major hurricane in the eastern Gulf of Mexico as early as tomorrow. It will bring heavy rains, strong winds, flash flooding, storm surge, along with isolated tornado activity along Florida's Gulf Coast. Floridians up and down the Gulf Coast should feel the impacts of this as up to 36 hours before actual landfall due to the size of the hurricane. This is a really, really big hurricane at this point. The diameter, the width of it's about 500 miles wide. So if you look at the cone and if you look at where they have the landfall going, I think the landfall is still Levy County. The impacts are going to be much, much broader than that. Of course, that track is still uncertain. It could absolutely wobble further into the peninsula or even further away from the peninsula. You will see storm surge in places like Southwest Florida, even though the storm is projected to be 100 or 150 miles off the coast of Southwest Florida. And so you look in Collier County, they've already issued voluntary evacuations for some of their coastal communities because the storm surge is likely to be significant given how big the storm is. A tropical storm warning has been issued for a portion of the Florida Keys from the Seven Mile Bridge south to Key West. Hurricane and tropical storm watches have been issued from Inglewood south to Naples. We also have storm surge watches in effect from Pinellas County down to the Florida Keys. Those watches are anticipated to become warnings later today. Now, some counties have begun issuing evacuation orders or voluntary evacuations. The important thing for people to know is to know the zone that you're in. You will have counties probably throughout this morning and into this afternoon identifying areas that are vulnerable for evacuation. So you should anticipate that if you're on counties. Decisions have to be made. So as we get into the northern Florida and into the panhandle, those decisions may not be today, but certainly for Southwest and Tampa Bay, be on the lookout for that because I know we've been conferring with a lot of the local officials. Those are going to happen. The way to go is to go to floridadisaster.org/plan prepare. floridadisaster.org/plan prepare. That will be able to allow you to look to see whether you are in an evacuation zone. And so if they do call for an evacuation of, say, Zone A, and you're in Zone A, then you know that, and you can take the appropriate action.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis at the Emergency Operations Center in Tallahassee this morning. He also says he's activating 2,500 National Guard troops and also preparing more than 2 million meals for residents once that hurricane hits. Associated Press adding this, as of Monday, Tampa and St. Petersburg appeared to be among the most likely targets for their first direct hit by a major hurricane since 1921. At the White House in Washington, D.C., the press secretary Karine Jean-Pierre with an update on the federal response.
Tomorrow we will be joined in the briefing room by FEMA Administrator Dion Criswell, who is in Miami today to assess ongoing hurricane planning and preparedness efforts. Over the weekend, the president approved Florida's emergency assistance request as soon as he received it and directed his team to surge federal assistance to the region well before landfall. FEMA has prepositions supplies at strategic locations in Florida and also Alabama. That includes generators, millions of meals, and millions of liters of water. FEMA also has staff on the ground supporting planning and preparation efforts. Tomorrow, Administrator Criswell will provide an update on the efforts underway in Florida to prepare for Hurricane Ian, as well as ongoing recovery efforts in Puerto Rico and also Alaska.
The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre in the White House briefing room today. President Biden also postponing a scheduled trip Tuesday to Florida because of Hurricane Ian. And NASA plans to bring its moon rocket back from the launch pad at the Kennedy Space Center and put it in the hangar. And that means the launch of the test flight, already delayed weeks due to an engine problem, will be delayed several more weeks at least. This is Washington Today. Russian President Vladimir Putin giving former U.S. National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden Russian citizenship, according to an official decree posted on the Russian government website. CNN reports that Edward Snowden, who admitted to leaking information about U.S. surveillance programs to the press, has been in Russia since 2013. He is facing espionage charges in the U.S. and up to 30 years in prison. In 2020, Edward Snowden and his wife applied for Russian citizenship. He had already been given permanent residency in Russia. That from CNN. Some reaction from the U.S. State Department today. Spokesman Ned Price questioned by AP reporter Matt Lee.
You've seen President Putin giving Russian citizenship to Edward Snowden. Back in 2013, when you guys, this building, the State Department, during the Obama administration, revoked his passport, it was made clear by one of your predecessors that this did not affect his citizenship, that he was still, as far as the U.S. government is concerned, an American citizen. And I just want to know if that is still, and I'm not asking about any kind of prosecution, so please don't refer me to the Justice Department. Is it still the belief of the administration that he is a U.S. citizen?
I'm not aware of any change in his citizenship status. I am familiar with the fact that he has in some ways denounced his American citizenship. I don't know that he's renounced it.
Right. Well, no, he hasn't. And in fact, when he applied for citizenship, he said he wasn't going to renounce it. But but there are ways in which the U.S. government can revoke one's citizenship. And as far as I know, he doesn't meet any of the, or hasn't met any of the criteria yet. One of the four is committing an act of treason, which I know you'll refer to the Justice Department on. But I just want to make sure that as far as you're concerned, he remains an American citizen. So he's now a dual U.S.-Russian citizen.
Our position has not changed. Mr. Snowden should return to the United States, where he should face justice as any other American citizen would. Perhaps the only thing that has changed is that as a result of his Russian citizenship, apparently now he may well be conscripted to fight in Russia's war in Ukraine.
The State Department spokesman Ned Price at today's news conference with reporters in the State Department briefing room. New York Times reports that opposition to the draft has grown in Russia since President Vladimir Putin announced last week that hundreds of thousands of civilians would be pressed into military service in the wake of embarrassing battlefield losses in Ukraine. At least 2,000 anti-war protesters have been arrested in Russia since the announcement, according to OVD Info, a rights group that monitors police activity. And this from Moscow Times. The Kremlin admitted Monday that errors had been made during the mobilization of reservists for the military action in Ukraine and said no decision had been taken to close Russia's borders. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov telling reporters, indeed, there are cases when the mobilization decree was violated. In some regions, governors are actively working to rectify the situation. Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine 7 months ago, there's been a debate in the U.S. government about whether to designate Russia as a state sponsor of terrorism. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham introducing a bill with Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal to do just that. Two other senators, Democrat Jeanne Shaheen of New Hampshire and Republican Tom Tillis of North Carolina, who are co-chairs of the Senate NATO Observer Group, asked today about their positions on this issue during a virtual discussion hosted by the Atlantic Council.
Do you believe Russia is a state sponsor of terrorism?
I do. All we have to do is to look at the scenes from Bucha and Izum, where we've uncovered torture chambers, mass graves, and I believe, sadly, that Vladimir Putin has been sponsoring terrorism. Rape as a weapon of war against the women of Ukraine. I think there's a lot of support in the Senate to look at Russia as a state sponsor of terrorism.
So I'll ask both of you this question. What's your message to President Biden, to the administration that's obviously been resisting that designation? Senator Shaheen, you first.
Well, I know that there is concern and on the part of the administration because they want to keep lines of communication open with Russia. And I appreciate that. My beef is not with the Russian people. I think most of the Russian people have been misinformed. They have been had propaganda from Putin about what's really happening in Ukraine. I don't think if they had been given the choice, they would have gone into this war without Putin. So I do think it's important for us to look at ways that we can continue to keep dialogue with the Russians. But we've got to hold Putin accountable for these war crimes. We can't let him or any other leader do what he has done in Ukraine and have the world walk away from that without holding him accountable and some of the perpetrators accountable. So I know that we're engaged in helping collect documents to look at the International Criminal Court and what could be done there. But I think we've got to look at other ways to ensure that there is accountability for what's happening here.
Senator Tillis, accountability versus dialogue?
I agree with Senator Shaheen. I think we both think that that Putin and his inner circle are absolutely guilty of being state sponsors of terror. All you have to do is look at their investment in the Wagner Group, not only in Ukraine, but in Africa, where they are killing, raping, and terrorizing people across the globe. The administration does have to walk a fine line when you're talking about a nuclear power and you're trying to de-escalate the situation. But I do believe that there is a strong recognition by members of Congress in both the House and the Senate that they are a state sponsor of terror, and they should be held accountable in the same way that any other organization has been designated as such.
Senator Tom Tillis is a Republican from North Carolina. You also heard from Senator Jeanne Shaheen, Democrat from New Hampshire. They are the co-chairs of the Senate NATO Observer Group, taking part in today's virtual event on the U.S. role in NATO, hosted by the Atlantic Council. The White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan was on NBC News' Meet the Press program on Sunday, asked about President Biden's position on this issue.
So right now we have five countries that are state sponsors of terror, Jake. You know this: Cuba, North Korea, Iran, and Syria. The Ukrainians want Russia to become the sixth country we put on that list. Why haven't we done that yet?
Well, President Biden has indicated that he is not certain that the state sponsor of terror designation specifically is the right fit for what's going on with Russia. But he's gone way beyond what we've done with some of the countries that you've listed in terms of the sheer comprehensiveness of the sanctions that we're applying. So as a practical matter, whether we're talking about denying Russia access to the technologies it needs to power its economy and its defense industrial base, cutting off its banks from the international financial system, mm-hmm. imposing personal sanctions on key oligarchs, the president has not pulled his punches at all. So this is just a matter of a particular tool and the degree to which the upside of it outweighs the downside, which is that it does tie the United States' hands and reduce our flexibility without adding a whole lot of economic pressure to Russia. So we'll continue to talk to the Ukrainians on this particular item, but we fully agree with the Ukrainian Prime Minister, who I've met with personally, that we need to continue to amp the pressure on Russia economically, and we will do so.
Jake Sullivan is the president's national security advisor, appearing on Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press. Senator Lindsey Graham, a co-sponsor of a bill that would designate Russia as a state sponsor of terror, writing in a press release as he introduced this bill with Senator Richard Blumenthal, Senator Graham a Republican, Senator Blumenthal a Democrat. Senator Graham writing, the designation would drastically curtail defense and technology exports to Russia, significantly reduce foreign assistance, and impose additional financial restrictions on Russia, and eliminate Russia's sovereign immunity in the eyes of U.S. courts, opening Russia's government to lawsuits and other civil claims from the families of victims of its state-sponsored terrorism. A story at Associated Press, Dateline Seoul, South Korea. A U.S. aircraft carrier and its battle group launched drills with South Korean warships off the Korean Peninsula's east coast on Monday in their first such training in 5 years, a day after North Korea test-fired a short-range ballistic missile in a possible response to the exercise. 4 days of drills are aimed at demonstrating the allies' powerful resolve to respond to North Korean provocations, in quotes, and improving their ability to perform joint naval operations, the South Korean Navy said in a statement. Today at the United Nations General Assembly in New York City, the North Korean ambassador to the UN, Kim Song, blaming the U.S. for the growing hostility on the Korean Peninsula.
The security environment of the Korean Peninsula is now caught in a vicious cycle of tensions and confrontation due to the growing hostility of the United States and its following forces against the DPRK. Recently, it is heading into a much more dangerous phase. One of the Trump excuses of the United States and its civil forces to justify their hostile policy and military threats against the DPRK is none other than the position of our self-defensive nuclear weapons. A few days ago, the U.S. President, just at this place, accused us, saying despite their efforts to begin serious and sustained diplomacy, the DPRK continues to blatantly violate U.N. sanctions. To put it clearly, we have never recognized such resolutions of the United Nations that impose pressure because we do not abide by the rules made by the United States unilaterally. We will not accept them in the future, too.
The interpreter for North Korea's ambassador to the United Nations, Kim Song, part of his speech today to the 77th UN General Assembly, which started last week, now going into the second week of speeches by the heads of countries. The U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris is in Tokyo today meeting with the Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. Vice President Harris will be attending the funeral on Tuesday of former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter Word for Word to get more of Washington's top stories sent to your inbox every day. Subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.